right where Starbucks
is. Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to a hearing. It is Tuesday, February 21st, 2012. I would note for the record that we do have a quorum present. And this afternoon we are taking up Senate File 1994, Sex Offender Community Notification. And this is Senator Limmer's bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chairman. Proceed whenever you are ready.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. Just for note, Mr. Chairman, do we have quorum? Have you announced quorum?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman, or Senator. Yes, I have announced, and we do have a quorum. And do you want to take up the A3 amendment right away to get it off?
Well, Mr. Chairman, before we get into the formality of presenting the bill, there's some background information that I think we have to review first. And then once we get into the bill proposal itself, I will be asking the committee to agree on an author's amendment.
Very well, Senator Limmer. Please proceed.
The issue of the how we treat sex offenders in the state of Minnesota has been a long history. I remember early in my life in the legislature as a member of the House, where this issue came up primarily as a result of some very serious and tragic events involving the criminal activity of a released sex offender from Stillwater Prison who tragically victimized one of our citizens. And as a result, the history of sex offenders and the programming that we offer changed considerably from that date. Policy directors basically created a pattern of treatment models, civil commitment, that skyrocketed from that early point. I think it was 19, well, I'll get the date wrong if I say it, but it was roughly 17, 18 years ago. But the traffic of our sexual offenders into civil commitment skyrocketed from that time and has continued to be at an extremely high level. Compromising resources as well as facilities since that time. As we begin to look at it, I think the goal of the state of Minnesota should always be the safety of its citizens. Safety is outlined in our first section and article of our state constitution. That's why we have a government, and it's the primary purpose is the safety of its citizens. But we also have other responsibilities of responsibility to the public purse, as well as the making of policies that are in fact constitutional all at the same time. For the last 4 to 5 months prior to the beginning of this session, a number of legislators, myself included, began to study Minnesota Sexual Offender Program based on the three elements of safety, cost, and constitutionality. We traveled roughly 800 to 1,000 miles throughout Minnesota reviewing different programs at Moose Lake, St. Peter, as well as deep discussion with the facilitators. We talked to prosecutors, public defenders, law enforcement, Department of Public Safety, not to mention Department of Corrections, Department of Human Services. Now, you may want to know why I'm bringing you down all of this memory lane, but the issue that we're going to be discussing today has a lot to do with the entire system, because if you don't understand what the system and the history of this sexual offender program and the reliance on civil commitment in a big institution, you won't understand the gravity of our decision today. As we did our work in reviewing the programs, it was a very good discussion. We talked to all of the members of different staff of these institutions, and they also are concerned, not so much about safety. I think safety is satisfied for the public by keeping people in civil commitment settings. But we also have kind of a bifurcated response as well. We have Department of Corrections that holds sex offenders in prisons. Not everyone is housed in civil commitment. We release members of the inmate population once they commute their sentence, sometimes not fully commuted. Sometimes we have released them to parole or probation under strict guidelines and strict supervision. The public doesn't seem to be too alarmed, or certain legislators don't seem to be too alarmed by that. But I think part of the reason is for most purposes, it's been a fairly good and responsible program. The areas of civil commitment, it seems to get invite a darker perspective on these offenders versus those that are released from prison. And as we look into the sexual offender program in the state of Minnesota, I think we have to understand that it is different. It's under civil law. It's not under criminal law. The people that are held there are for an indefinite period of time as opposed to a definite period of sentencing in our correction system. The cost factor is certainly different. You're looking at roughly a difference of anywhere from $50 to $70 a day for a Department of Corrections inmate per day cost, and compared to the civil commitment process of over $300 a day. They undergo treatment models, treatment experiences, 24/7, 7 days a week, has some element of treatment in it. But at the very same time that we put such a heavy resource application to treatment models, we also do not have, even to this day, well, maybe one small exception a number of years ago. But other than that, the 600 and I think 19 people that are committed to a civil commitment process have not gotten out. They've been promised that if they go through treatment and if they're successful, they will eventually someday earn their treatment-inspired freedom in a limited way. That hasn't happened for the 18 to 20 years that Minnesota has had this program, which raises the other question beyond just cost, and that is the constitutionality of such a program that we now have. There should be dire concern about the constitutionality of this issue. There are some members in the other chamber that refuse to have a hearing on it. They are critical of a draft copy of a suggested ideas, and they label it as a bill, and they refuse to have a hearing on it. We cannot ignore the issue. And this issue is coming at us whether we like it or not, whether we advance the bill before us today or not. And we have to understand that if MSOP is found unconstitutional, there may be much more dire consequences than worrying about whether one person is in a secure halfway house or not. If the program is found unconstitutional, we may have to be concerned about patients that will be immediately released to the public without a halfway house as any form of protection because of the program perhaps being found unconstitutional. Now that I've raised the constitutionality question, I'm sure there'll be other people that'll quickly say, Minnesota's program is fine. There's no threat of constitutionality to it. But I don't know if I would want to run the risk of running a court case up to the Supreme Court based on some of the things that I've discovered in my research. I think there is valid concern about constitutionality. And certainly the cost factor is certainly not only the per day cost, but think of a balloon and you keep putting air into the balloon and you never release it or vent that air, eventually the system's going to burst. And that's basically what we have in Minnesota. estimates are telling us from facilitators that study MSOP that we could be doubling this patient population in as early as 5 to 6 years from now. That will require another prison or another health facility, and it is going to be very costly. There are others that follow this type of thing and say, this is what they deserve. Let's just shut the door, throw the key away, but we'll just keep filling up one institution after another after another. I'm not necessarily fond of that idea. I don't think it's good policy making. When you also study the other states of New York and Wisconsin and Texas that seem to have been able to handle their populations, one of the things that I've noticed about MSOP is not the program itself, but the precursors to the program, the prosecution elements of this population, the judicial reaction, the severity and the lack of severity of sentencing and the orders for civil commitment, very wide range. And the one thing that I can admit and what I see is there's a lack of uniformity, on the part of prosecutors on how to address civil commitment, lack of treatment models in some communities, and in other communities there's an adequate amount of resources. It seems like we have invented about 20 years ago when the legislature then rushed to policy making, much in the same way that we're talking about today with this one bill before us. Very little discussion in committees, but a quick rush to policy making to make sure that the public was safe, but in its rush to judgment, created institutions that never relieve themselves of any population, and that they simply grow and grow and grow, and with a 24/7 treatment model become very, very expensive. And it soon will have to collapse on itself simply because of the weight of the programming that we require. The other element is we don't really know if the programming works. If no one is ever released or advanced to another treatment model, like a halfway house, how would you know that your treatment ever works when no one is ultimately tested? And we're not advocating an immediate release. No one would ever advocate that. But a stepped, supervised, intensively watched individual from one civil commitment to another is necessary to determine whether or not treatment is ever required. As I look at this, I'm going to recommend that the bill that we have before us is passed. But I want to make sure that we as a state of Minnesota have an adequate hearing, have an adequate discussion about this whole issue. That has been denied in the House. I'm sorry that the House doesn't follow the principles of committee process. The imminency that was discussed is not. The individual in question that will be released can go as far as March 10th or 12th for the ultimate transfer of that individual into a halfway house. So the imminency is not the issue. I'm glad we have had an opportunity to have this discussion today. But I wanted to make sure that everyone knew that we have a long history. We have a system that's, I think, in balance of whether it's constitutional or not. The opportunity to advance someone to a different treatment modality may be important simply because it would lessen the impact on the constitutionality question. If someone never gets to advance, then I would say that then we're going to aggravate the constitutionality question. I'm going to get into the bill itself, and then there's a few people here that would like to make some comments on the bill itself, not on my diatribe. But if anyone has any questions on the MSOP observations that I've made already, I'd be more than happy to discuss with them right now.
Any members have any questions? Senator Engelbretson.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any questions, but I have some comments. Would you like those reserved till later, Senator Limmer, if that's all right?
Sure, that's fine.
Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, please proceed, Senator Lim.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1994 is a bill that would allow community notification to the public that would be surrounding an area of a residential facility that may exercise an option to have persons that may be transferred from the Minnesota Sexual Offender Program to a halfway house. One thing that we might want to remember is the halfway house in this question would have been an intensive supervised role. I don't think the public really understands the role of a halfway house in this regard with this type of patient. And I hope that the individuals that are more familiar with halfway houses can fill us in on it, because I think there's a lot of question about what is a halfway house, how does this individual, how would these people fit into this setting? And as we look at that, I think a lot of questions may be answered on the part of the public if we had that discussion. I'm going to have counsel explain the bill and also the author's amendment. It's a technical amendment, but nevertheless, perhaps counsel can fill in the technical details at this time.
Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, Senator Limmer did describe the bill, but currently under the community notification law, there's a stay of notification which is applicable to offenders who are released from confinement and then are being placed in halfway houses, so that the level 2 or 3 notification would not take place during the period that they're in the halfway house. What the bill before you does is it provides an exception to that for persons who are committed under the civil commitment statute as sex offenders. So if they're being released and being sent to a halfway house, the notification could proceed. And then in terms of the amendment, the A3 amendment, it's just a technical amendment. What it does is it amends the community notification law to basically provide a cross-reference to the new language in this bill, because the new language in the bill before you amends the civil commitment law. So it just kind of makes those two provisions work together a little bit better, hopefully.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A3 amendment as an author's amendment.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. The A3 amendment is just in the process of being passed out to the members, so that we'll give them just a moment to take a look at it. And members, if I understand correctly, the change on the A3 amendment is on page 2, line 1. Is that correct, Mr. Backus?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any members have any questions with respect to the A3 amendment? Just for the record, I'm waiting for the members to have a chance to look at the amendment. Page 2, line 1. Any questions with respect to the A2 amendment? I'm sorry, A3 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, A3 amendment is adopted. Senator Lim.
Well, members, the bill is before you in an amended fashion. But I have a couple of questions that, since I'm not the original author of this bill was a message from the House, originated in the House, and I need to ask counsel a couple of questions before I give a final recommendation on it, and perhaps counsel can answer. Are we in any way, when we, on lines 13 of the bill, where we talk of disclosing information on individuals living in residential facilities, since this is a therapeutic treatment program, are we violating anyone's medical privacy rights via HIPAA if we disclose information. I need to know that.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Pontius.
We're going to do a tag team here. I think that's more my question. Clearly both federal and state law restrict the release of health records or medical information, so you couldn't release things about treatment, medication, diagnosis. Now, if you're just releasing an address of where somebody's going to be living, rather than, say, a treatment, what would be considered a treatment facility, then I think you're okay. I mean, I think an argument could be made that a residential facility, if you're just saying that they're going to be in a residential facility as part of their treatment program, that that's medical information. I actually just started looking into this issue about an hour ago, and my initial take on it was when you combine sort of the federal law with the community notification requirements, I think you're okay just disclosing an address. You could not give any more detail, clearly, about their treatment, their diagnosis, more specific information.
And Mr. Chair and Council,
Senator Limmer.
There has been some recent news accounts where some enterprising reporters have, I think, actually informed in the form of their reporting where this halfway house might be. Would we be violating this person's HIPAA privacy rights by revealing the address? I think that's important because as we continue dialoguing and discussing this issue, it would help us set some parameters of our own discussion.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think you could release an address, but then you start getting into more gray area when you start saying, well, they are in a residential, if it was considered a treatment facility for purposes of medical records laws. Now, I don't know enough about these residential facilities or halfway houses to know how they fit in terms of being a provider or not of health services, and maybe somebody from the department can answer that question better, but...
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions on the bill itself? We have witnesses that would like to give testimony as well.
I'm going to delay just a little bit here so that Senator Latz has a chance to swallow ask his question. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm not going to try to answer any questions on this. But I'm wondering, given Ms. Pontius's assessment, more importantly, the caveats that she placed along with it, just having started to look into it an hour ago because this is an obviously very accelerated process, and some uncertainty about releasing any more information even beyond an address, what benefit is there to the community of knowing that some person is living at an address? Certainly there'll be 1,000 questions that will follow from that, and probably no answers other than we can't tell you without violating federal law. So I wonder if any of the witnesses that will testify, or Ms. Pontius or Mr. Backus, can illumine us a little bit more on how to approach that situation. And whether this is, or whether we can even answer some of those questions today.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure if this is directly responsive to your question, but my understanding is with community notification, generally for a level 3 notification, there'll be notification of the general area of the residence, often like, you know, the 2700 block of some street, description of the offender, a photograph, description of the pattern of behavior that the offender has been known to display. So I would imagine things like that would not be prohibited by HIPAA. I think that would be generally public information that would be able to be disclosed in this case.
Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chairman, my follow-up question is that having been involved in several hundred community notification meetings that in my prior service was that they were being released not to a treatment facility, though, but to typically a residence, so that they were not currently being treated. It was not a function of them being still under treatment when they were being released that the community notification was done in, under that auspices. So I'm not sure if this is the same set of facts if we're moving them from a treatment facility into a new treatment facility. One hospital to another hospital would be more comparable than one residence to another residence, which is what I think the original community notification envisioned.
Senator Harrington, was there a question or just a comment?
More of a comment that it, okay. I'm not sure that that the guidance from the from community notification is necessarily relevant or directive in this case, because halfway houses, we deal with halfway houses a lot as .com, and typically you get no information from the halfway houses, and they cite HIPAA typically that they don't provide information because it is patient information that is restricted under that set of guidelines, which is very different than what we would do when we would do a community notification meeting where we were releasing somebody to a private house where there was no treatment involved. So I'm just questioning whether the two are the same.
And I'd like to follow up a little bit on Senator Harrington's comments, and perhaps Commissioner Jessen could join Senator Limmer at the testifying table. Commissioner Jessen, thank you for coming forward, and I'm not, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I don't know if you're the right person to ask this question of, but this is an area that I am very unfamiliar with. I got a couple of questions. First of all, can you tell me when the risk level assessment for a sex offender is done? Is it when they go into confinement, when they're discharged? When is this risk assessment completed by MSOP?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, let me answer that question, you know, best I can. I'll also note we have several people from the program who have more expertise than I do in some of this. Certainly there's a risk assessment done, Mr. Chair, when the county is considering whether or not to bring civil commitment proceedings against an individual. You know, originally, as many of you probably know, there's an assessment done at the Department of Corrections to decide who even to refer to the county attorney. And then the county attorney makes a risk assessment, looks at a number of things, and decides whether to proceed with the civil commitment process. You know, there's also done certainly before someone during their program, during the treatment program, especially if a client petitions for provisional discharge, their risk assessment's done as part of that process, you know, both by the treatment team to determine whether the treatment team will support the provisional discharge petition. There's also a risk assessment that's done, at least certainly in this case, you know, that's done and looked at by experts, including the court-appointed independent medical expert that looked at this situation. So risk assessments are done at different points in the process. If you want more, detailed information on how that works, I'll be happy to point you to people here who know more than I do.
And in the case that brought us here on this rather expedited method of legislation, was a risk assessment completed on this individual?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the risk assessments are done. Once again, I'm not the risk assessment expert, but as I understand it, there are, you know, in the risk assessment, there are some static risk assessment factors as well as dynamic ones. You know, and so when I reviewed all of the matters in this file, I looked at the risk assessment data, you know, on this individual that's the subject of this provisional discharge court order.
And I take it then that you were in agreement with the three-judge panel that this transfer to the halfway house for this individual was appropriate?
Mr. Chair, the position I took, because as commissioner, I have to state whether, my opinion to the court before the court makes its order, so did the county. And my position was that I did not oppose provisional discharge to this facility for this individual.
Okay, and then one last question, Commissioner. When I look at the statute that deals with the end of confinement review committee, this was, in effect, as I understand it, a transfer from a facility to a halfway house, which is another facility. Is MSAOP looking at this as an end of confinement transfer, or is it within the system type of a transfer, which would, and was the end of confinement review completed on this individual?
Mr. Chair, when you're using the term end of confinement review, I'm not sure where you're.
I'll help you.
Okay.
I'm looking at Minnesota Statute 244.052, subdivision 3, and it talks about end of confinement review to be conducted on a case-by-case basis so that the public risk posed by the predatory offenders who are about to be released from confinement. And what I'm trying to find out is DHS treating this as a release from confinement or a transfer to another facility?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Commissioner Jessup.
Could I ask Robin Vubinson, who's an attorney for MSOP, to address that specific question?
Please.
With your permission.
Please do. Like I said, I wasn't too sure who the correct individual was. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I'm a legal manager with DHS and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. In terms of the assignment of a risk level, under the statute that the chair's referenced, that needs to occur before the individual is released from confinement. Many of the clients in MSOP come to MSOP with a risk level assigned through corrections before they're released from the Department of Corrections. For individuals who have come to us before that system was put in place, MSOP interprets the release from confinement as when they're going to be transferred to a less restrictive environment, which is the Community Preparation Services program on the St. Peter campus.
And, excuse me, Mr. Benson, in this case, that risk and committee review was, in fact, completed, correct?
Yes, it was. It was, I can't give a specific date, but it was completed more than 5 years ago.
Oh. Was there a release from confinement review done recently, considering the transfer that this individual is going to be going from his present facility into a halfway house?
Mr. Chair, members, the purpose of the Chapter 244 or Section 244 is to assign a risk level. Once that risk level is assigned, the individual can petition to have it changed based on changed circumstances. However, once it is assigned, there's not a trigger for a reassessment of it simply because he's moving from one location to another.
Let me try the question this way.
Okay.
What information was presented to the three-judge panel which convinced the three-judge panel to transfer this individual to this upcoming halfway house, and who presented that information to the three-judge panel?
Mr. Chair, I have experience in those matters when I was at the Attorney General's office, so I can speak to that. And then some of the information regarding the current proceeding. In terms of what the three-judge panel considered, they received, it's a standard case, that they received a number of exhibits and documents, which include the risk assessment, which Commissioner Jessen referred to. They also receive the independent examiner's report, which is a report done to the court. They receive packet of information which includes what risk level was assigned by the end of confinement review committee for this case and all of the MSOP cases. So they were certainly aware, they had the documentation that identified what risk level the individual was assigned through the corrections process. They also had the more recent risk assessments that were provided as part of the proceeding.
Did they receive, Mr. Benson, any testimony from any individuals from DHS or MSOP in terms of a recommendation?
Mr. Chair, the hearing on February 3rd did not include testimony. Individuals were prepared to testify if the court had asked for testimony.
And I got one last question. This is just to throw out to anybody that may be able to answer it. What we are really doing within Senate File 1994 is to, in effect, remove an exception for someone who moves into, you know, this halfway house. Does anybody have any legislative history as to why that exception was placed in the statute in the first place?
Mr. Chair, members, you know, I do not have that legislative history, but I did want to make the chair and the committee aware of some people here, you know, who may be able to address this. And certainly I would defer to Senator Limmer, who, you know, has a lot of expertise in all of this. But we do have here the Department of Corrections, folks who are responsible for the community notification process are here. They may, because they're responsible for that process, they may have more background about how it was set up, why it was set up, and why the exceptions were created at the time. We also have the halfway house provider here, who may be able to talk to you from the provider perspective about why this exception for, you know, not having the community notification in this situation where it's a licensed DOC halfway house, why that was worked from their perspective. And just so you know, Mr. Chair and members, we also have Ralph Smith from the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program here, who, if there are questions about supervision in the community, will be able to address what that supervision would look like.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions from any of the members of the committee? Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, and I might have missed it stepping out here. How many level threes do you have in the facility now?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbrecht.
Is that St. Peter or?
We have, as Senator Limmer mentioned, 635 clients as of January 1st. I believe all of them have been assigned risk levels. Many of them, of course, are level three, given the nature of civil commitment and who we are civilly committing. I do not have that number immediately available about how many of those are assigned a risk level of three, but we can provide that information.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you. I would appreciate that information. And so I can assume then that probably the majority of the 600 are probably level threes.
That would be my assumption.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I was recently apprised of the information.
Mr. Benson.
There are 453 individuals in MSOP who are assigned a risk level of 3. 73 have a level 2. 3 have a level 1. And there are 110 who have not yet been assigned a level. As I mentioned earlier, they would be assigned a level if they were to progress toward the less restrictive facility placement that's on the St. Peter campus.
Mr. Backus, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, I guess slightly different information. As of I have here, as of July 1, 2010, there were approximately 203 level 3 offenders living in the community in Minnesota. So I think, you know, I think there may be some confusion among the members in terms of, you know, the separate process, which is community notification and all that entails, versus the separate risk assessments that Commissioner Jessen was testifying to. So, you know, there most times when we talk about the level three offenders, it's the people who have gone through DOC who are not really civil committed that are in the community. So.
Next, we have got, unless there's any other comments or questions, Senator Ingram.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So to be clear then, there's not 453 still in the MSOP system. That includes all the level threes in the state.
No, those numbers they provided are of MSOP clients as of January 1st.
Right. Thank you,
Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would the legislation then require for those who are living in the community, not at the St. Peter campus, the 200 some? if I understand the numbers right, does they also be subject to community notification, even though they're already in the community?
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, the bill as it's drafted applies only to an individual who is under civil commitment. So the level three offenders who were not civilly committed and are residing in the community are, if they are in a residential facility, the stay of notification that Mr. Backus referred to would still apply to them. But if they're not in one of those residential facilities, they would still have community notification of the scope provided for by the law, as would an MSOP provisional discharge if they were not in a residential facility.
Next, we have as a testifier, Mr. Kane. Could you please approach the table? Mr. Kane, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N. I'm the president of R.S. Eden, an organization that, among other things, operates three halfway houses licensed by the Department of Corrections. And I'd like to start by thanking this body for taking a deliberative approach to this because, you know, I think when the original framers of the legislation that created MSOP did so 20 years ago, I can't imagine that they had any idea that we'd have 635 people in there today with no one having been released. And taking a deliberative approach, make sure that we don't find ourselves in a situation where unintended consequences at a later date come up and euphemistically bite us in an area that we don't want to be bit. Several months ago, we were approached by the Department of Human Services to consider contracting for placement of people being released on provisional discharge from the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. We wrestled with the request. Quite frankly, we were concerned with the dramatic public attention we knew would accompany any pending release. These were people with heinous crimes and criminal backgrounds coming from a treatment program that had never released anyone in the 19 years of its existence. Ultimately, we came to the decision to contract because it was consistent with our mission and because it was the right thing to do. We believe, and I think policymakers agree, that the 24/7, 365 supervision, accountability, and support we provide, coupled with GPS monitoring, random drug testing, and polygraph testing, one-to-one supervision, including no unescorted travel in the community, and continued treatment, is the best and most thorough package to assure public safety and at the same time satisfy the judicial mandate that these offenders, or at least in this case this offender, be provisionally discharged. And incidentally, in the 37 years our halfway houses have operated, and I think I can speak for the others that contract for this service, neither I nor anyone else can remember a situation where anyone was accused of a sex crime while under our supervision. But being that there's never been a patient released from MSOP, we're all breaking new ground. And in so doing, I believe that it's less than prudent to rush to judgment before weighing in on all the potential consequences of our actions, both intended and unintended. You as a body are charged with balancing the goals of offender reintegration with public safety and the public's need to know. Not a job I would want, but I would ask in your deliberations that you consider the following. Public notification has always focused on those offenders who will be interacting with the public. In this case, they will have no opportunity to interact with the neighbors of the halfway house physically or socially. Doing broad public notification, especially with posting on the internet, only serves to label a neighborhood as bad. And I'll elaborate on that a little bit. If you do notification on an offender right now coming out of DOC, in all likelihood, you have one in Brooklyn Park and one in Brooklyn Center and one in South Minneapolis and one in North Minneapolis. And you're having periodic hearings that are not causing the public to identify one location as the holding ground, if you will, for offenders. You start having multiple hearings on one location where they're going to this particular halfway house, you'll impact on the view of the neighborhood, and you'll impact on the view that the neighbors have of the facility that they've been okay with for years. Labeling facilities could very well affect surrounding property values. Number of buyers lost in the neighborhood would be hard to assess because it's so easy to write off a neighborhood where a level three, or in this case possibly more than one level three, resides in one location. Labeling facilities could undermine their ability to go about their business without irrational interference based upon the publication of issues that are addressed in the facility and yet not of concern to the neighborhood as long as the person is in the halfway house. All of our halfway houses operate with the support of the neighborhoods we're located in. They've never had an issue with these. I won't say that. There have been minor issues that have come up. We have one woman who's convinced that any time someone drives down the street with their radio blasting that it has to be one of our tenants. It's not. But they, for the most part, they've not had issue with these facilities. Knowing the faces and the specifics about people that are there as opposed to just knowing that there are serious offenders there is a dramatic difference, and it could change their perception and their willingness to have us in the neighborhood. Right now, they're satisfied with who we are. They see us as good neighbors. They experience us as being responsive to neighborhood concerns and maintaining the integrity and the quality of the neighborhood where we're located. Outsiders could come into the area and disrupt both the operation of the facility, the reintegration goals of the residents, and normal daily life for the neighborhood. And last, if the neighborhood becomes sufficiently opposed to the halfway house, halfway houses could opt not to take serious offenders or in rare instances cease to exist altogether. And given the possibility that the number of people like Mr. Oppheim could expand either by design of the legislature or by design of the Supreme Court, I believe the halfway houses are perhaps more important now than ever. As I said, our facilities operate with the support of the neighborhoods where they're housed, and we have for over three decades striven to be good neighbors, protecting both the safety and the integrity of the neighborhoods where we're located. We have excellent partnerships with supervising agents and law enforcement to ensure that every possible precaution is in place to bring about the safest and most desirable results. In fact, I find the fact that, to the best of my knowledge, no one from law enforcement or prosecution is requesting this bill speaks volumes. I'd like to think that it's not a leap of faith to suggest that it can be interpreted as a testament to the effectiveness of the current policy. I'm not here to tell you to vote for or against the bill. To do so would be presumptuous. It would also be asking you to demonstrate a degree of courage that I'm not sure I'd have were I in the situation and were the roles to be reversed. I'm asking you to cautiously and deliberately take into consideration all the variables and make your decision and determine whether or not this proposed action is actually needed or simply a solution for a problem that's not yet proven to exist and a reaction to one man potentially being released. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. The next testifier I have on the list is a Mr. Mark Hazy. You would, Senator Harrington?
Mr. Kane, before you depart, I was just wondering, could you cut? You mentioned procedures between local law enforcement and halfway houses that are typically in place before someone's released. Could you describe those a little bit more fully?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, it varies considerably, but whenever someone is released to the halfway house, it's public information. I believe the Department of Corrections notifies law enforcement where they're going to be housed. We've had very good relationships with law enforcement. They've been very responsive to our needs, and I think we've been responsive to theirs. I may be jumping to conclusions, but I don't think there's ever been somebody released to our halfway house where the police department was not made aware of it.
Thank you.
Mr. Hazy, if you would, identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Mark Haase, H-A-A-S-E. I'm the Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice. The Council is a Minneapolis-based nonprofit. Our mission is to build community capacity to address the causes and consequences of crime through research, demonstration, and advocacy. We've been around since 1957. We have programs for ex-offenders and their families, and we also have programs for victims of crime. So we approach these issues from both of those angles. What brings us here today is our part of our mission. One way we see our mission is to help Minnesota create safer, stronger, and more just communities, and to help this body create criminal justice policies that really do get us towards those ultimate goals that I think we all share. Unfortunately, what often happens is these issues get sped up. They get based on fear. The evidence, the research, the real problems get lost in the political process. And so I would like to echo some of the comments you've already heard in asking that you take a slower approach. I greatly appreciate Senator Limmer's approach on this and other issues, although I do disagree with him on this particular piece of legislation today. I also want to say that the Council on Crime and Justice does not own or operate any halfway houses, so we don't have any specific interest from that perspective. But we do support support Dan Kane's testimony. I guess I'd like to say the real issue here is public safety today, isn't it? This is not a justice issue. It's, are we making the public safer? If a constituent asks you why you voted for this bill, I assume your response would be because we needed this to make your community safer. We would argue that this legislation, in fact, does not do that. We already heard from Mr. Kane, who runs a halfway house, that this has the potential of lessening the options we have for placing these individuals. Senator Limmer also talked about that issue. There's another public safety issue that hasn't been addressed, and to describe that, let me take off my organizational policy wonk hat for a minute and become a citizen for a moment. Maybe put yourself in this situation. Imagine that you or I live near one of these halfway houses, and this bill passes. We start to get notifications that very dangerous people are moving into the neighborhood. Let's say we get, the number of people being released picks up. We get two or three of these in a year that people are going to this halfway house. We may, have different levels of education about what's happening there, but let's say we don't know exactly what the secure situation is or isn't. We don't know exactly where this person lives. We're going to start to get complacent. Oh, here's another one. Here's another one. Or we might think, well, I heard there's this halfway house nearby. That means they're in a secure environment. Well, now let's go ahead a little bit and imagine that this individual who is subject to this bill gets released from the halfway house, truly released into the community, and moves in another house, several blocks on the other side, and I get another notification. Is my awareness going to be as heightened when I get that notification? I think it's probably not. And I think that's something we do on all these notification issues is as we expand them to a wider group of people, a wider group of situations, suddenly these notifications don't mean anything to me. And I personally, as a citizen, want them to mean something. When somebody who is, has a history of child sexual abuse moves very close to me, I want to know about that. But if they're going to be in this secure facility where they're highly supervised, I know that there's some kind of facility there. I don't know that I need to know about that all the time. And those who are less educated about the issue, maybe actually be better off not knowing that all those people are in that secure facility, but when somebody is released unsupervised in their area, they should be on heightened alert. So I wanted to bring that piece of the public safety issue and just reiterate that, I hope that when you vote, however you vote on this issue, you can truly tell yourself that you're increasing public safety by the vote that you take, or at least not hurting public safety. I also wanted to just quickly touch on the legislative history. I haven't done actual research on the legislative history, but I do think I've been told that there was a deliberate reason to exclude these halfway houses from the notification and wanted to make it easier for them to have these services. It wasn't a loophole. And the very fact that it's in the statute tells me that it's not a loophole. There was a specific reason to exclude halfway houses from this notification. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Haase. The next testifier would be a Mr. Jerry Kaplan. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kaplan. If you would please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Gerald Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N. I'm the executive director of Alpha Human Services. I'm also a licensed psychologist. Alpha Human Services is the only community-based adult inpatient program that's licensed and certified by the Department of Corrections. I'd like to distinguish it from a halfway house. It's really a residential treatment program, and it's very long-term. Typically, people would be there at least several years, sometimes as long as 4 or 5 years, even though only a portion of that is while they're in residence, then there's a transition phase. It's a very highly structured program. There's a great deal of supervision. The offenders are held very much accountable. Again, we, like other sex offender programs nationally, we use polygraph as a way to authenticate somebody's past sexual history and whether they're complying with program rules and expectations. To be honest with you, if there's a program that should be used as a resource for people that are being released from the state hospital, from MSOP, our program would be the one. And in fact, we've been asked to consider to take such individuals on a number of occasions. I might want to add that it was a very deliberate attempt at protecting the integrity of the community-based residential facilities to put that exclusion in the law when it was being written. And in fact, I sat in Representative Bishop's office with a police detective from Seattle as those exemptions and other aspects of the bill were actually drafted. The concern was that if over and over again the community is hypersensitized to people being released in their community, that it would be inflammatory and eventually create problems. Well, you know, I know it would create problems. I can tell you what's happened. Every time I have considered taking civil commitment cases, oftentimes at the request of the Department of Human Services, it's just been a firestorm politically. On one occasion, I decided at 11 o'clock in the morning that we would take civil commitment cases. By 1 o'clock, our city council member wanted to have a meeting with me. By 3 o'clock, Channel 11 was there with this, you know, guess where so-and-so is going to go. And then Hennepin County was unhappy. On another case, we had a council member that was up for re-election, and what we experienced was that our facility became an issue for her re-election. The end result is there was an amendment authored for the ordinances in the city of Minneapolis, which would, I got a notice in the mail, would amortize community corrections facilities. And I thought, well, what does that mean, and how does that affect us? But I put it into an electronic thesaurus, and the first definition was get rid of. We had over $40,000 in legal fees to address that issue. I also want to point out we've been treating criminal sex offenders for 37 years. We've never had somebody commit an offense in the immediate neighborhood. We've had a handful in 37 years. Literally, you could count them on one hand that have committed some kind of an offense while they were still in some stage of the program. Our crime rates are below that of the neighborhood around us. My concern about not having that exclusion for community-based facilities is that, given the political pressure, I was interested in thinking that we again would consider taking civil commitment cases. You know, I've talked to the president of the Minneapolis City Council, and I've talked to some of the Hennepin County commissioners, and I think we're in a position that maybe we could be a resource again for the department. Well, we never have in the past, but in the future we could be a resource for the Department of Human Services. This kind of notification would really kill that, I think. It's so inflammatory to the neighborhood. And others have said, you know, is it really contribute to public safety? And I really don't think so. I mean, our record would speak to that. We've had level three offenders that have not had community notification until they left our facility. We've also had people that would have been civilly committed that were placed in our program. They just simply haven't, just dropped the petition or not proceeded because they wanted to try another treatment option. And I felt we could take those individuals even though, because they had not yet been civilly committed. There's a growing body of research, and that's what I would encourage the committee to perhaps delay a decision and to really take a look at the research that's out there, because there's an increasing amount of research that suggests that community notification has no bearing at all on reoffense. And I think the Minnesota Department of Corrections could be very helpful in providing some of that research. So I guess in summary, what I would say is that by removing that exclusion and inflaming the community over and over again, we really might create a situation where the opposite of what we really want to have happen. And that's that if you lose more of the resources because of the politics involved, so that those halfway houses aren't options, I mean, it's too bad that our program hasn't been an option, that the community's really going to be less safe than being in a program with that kind of intensive supervision without the community notification. Our program has worked closely with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to be certain that community notification and registration, et cetera, is done when people leave our facility. It's not taken lightly.
Mr. Kaplan, it was my understanding that the reason for this, the expediency with which this bill is moving through the legislature, is because we are dealing with an extraordinary circumstance in a very unusual, I don't know if that's the right word, unusual individual. Am I, given your testimony, is it correct that you or other halfway houses have dealt with similar individuals and have never had any type of crimes resulting from?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I can't speak for other programs. I can only speak for ours. And I can't say that we've actually had somebody who was provisionally discharged. I can only remember years ago we had somebody who was provisionally discharged as mentally ill and dangerous, but he was a sex offender. So I can't say that specifically we've had those individuals. But listening to some of the testimony in the House, there seemed to be a great concern that he had a pretty lengthy criminal history and a pretty robust history of molesting children. But who doesn't that's been civilly committed? I mean, that's how you get yourself civilly committed. He spent many, many years in treatment. I can't speak to his risk. I've never met the man. I've never reviewed any of the reports. But I do have confidence in the decisions that have been made. The halfway houses have had many, many level three offenders. We have a contract with the Department of Corrections, and the only people that have been placed in our residential program by the Department of Corrections are level three offenders. We haven't had a problem with them committing crimes in the community. In fact, I get into trouble when sometimes I testify and say that level 3 offenders have a 5% reoffense rate, probably because it's that low because of the intensive supervision and the treatment resources that are provided for them.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Senator Lentz.
Mr. Kaplan, you know, am I to understand then that your treatment facility has had plenty of level 3 sex offenders, people categorized at the same risk level as Mr. Oppheim, the difference being they were released from DOC directly to your facility, but in Mr. Oppheim's case, he went from DOC to St. Peter for years of treatment before he's being released to a community facility such as yours.
Mr. Kaplan.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, yes, we have had level 3 offenders. I can't say that they're all like those that would be released from MSOP, since, you know, there's discretion at each level. And there's a reason why somebody is referred in the first place for civil commitment and ultimately committed, which would, I hope, indicate that they are a greater risk to reoffend than those individuals that would come to us directly from the Department of Corrections. Otherwise, they shouldn't be civilly committed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lentz.
Mr. Kaplan, there was a period of time when there were far fewer level 3 sex offenders that were referred for possible civil commitment in the first place. Was there not? So there is at least some category of level 3 civilly committed persons that in the past would not have been civilly committed, would instead have been released directly from DOC to a facility such as yours.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I believe that's true, that there's certainly an overlap in the type of people that historically would go to a residential treatment program, and now they're being, well, first of all, the change in sentencing system to sentencing guidelines made a pretty significant difference. Whereas certain types of offenders are absolutely destined for a prison sentence and not to be placed on probation as they perhaps would have been previously. The other thing is, you know, initially when sentencing guidelines went into effect, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree was a 43-month sentence with one-third off for good time. And so those sentences were much shorter. Now it's 144 months. For criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. The modern era of civil commitment actually was not the Rodriguez murder of Drew Shadeen. It actually occurred with the murder of Mary Foley in Honeywell parking ramp in 1988 or 1989 by an offender named David Thomas. And David Thomas had done a certain amount of prison time. He'd been released. He stole a car, went back to prison. He was released again. He committed that murder. There were some other murders which had occurred at about the same time, and there was outrage about the length of sentences. He actually, and then the legislature passed a bill that would have, on the front end of sentences, have judges consider people for civil commitment or a dual commitment, both to the Department of Corrections and to be civilly committed at that time. But that was really the beginning of the modern era, and then it just exploded with Drew Shadeen's murder.
So, Senator Lentz.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Just to follow up then, it sounds to me like there are a lot of individuals that have gone to and through your facility that are comparable to those who are now in the civil commitment system, but those who have gone directly to your facility who have, without community notification, not posed any specific threat to the community.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Actually, they have a number of our offenders who came to us directly from the court and were unsuccessful in treatment. And without any break in custody at all, they ended up being sentenced to prison and then ultimately were not 100% successful. And those that are not successful in the program, and in fact, many people do not complete the program, they go back to court. And just about all will be sentenced to prison. And we get court orders constantly for records when there's a petition being filed in district court for civil commitment. But Senator, I would love to work with, I think some with the Department of Corrections are going to have their hair stand up, but I'd love to work and propose an alternative sentencing system, which, as time goes on, it would eliminate the need for civil commitment. But the problem is we're stuck with it for many years to come because of, number one, the people that are down there, and number two, the people that are on shorter sentences. But I was on Governor Pawlenty's sex offender policy commission, and I thought we came up with a very comprehensive sentencing scheme which was very cohesive, rather than having one part after another added with sentencing enhancements for certain types of offenders, where, you know, I thought our recommendation, but it was brought forward really only some of the most extreme measures from what we had suggested and what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission had suggested. I enjoy the opportunity to share some of my ideas, and also on a releasing authority for both civil commitment cases and then for indeterminate sentences at the Department of Corrections.
Just, if I may, one follow-up.
Senator Lights.
The other part of my comment, I guess, was that at least in the situation we're dealing with now, we have someone who's served their prison time and has gone through extensive secured facility treatment at MSOP in St. Peter, which one might conclude would be an added safety benefit, further reducing their risk to the community when they're released again to a secured or at least fully contained facility with oversight 24 hours a day. I guess what I'm asking and what I'm commenting on is it sounds like the risk levels may not be very different, if at all, between those who have gone straight to community facilities and those who have gone through the civil commitment program and then end up in a community facility. And so it raises the question, why should the community notification process be any different?
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, there certainly is an overlap, but I have to believe that there's a reason why a number of those people have been civilly committed. There's no question. I mean, we have had people participate in our program safely who later were civilly committed because they did not successfully complete treatment. I think that history would suggest that there really isn't a need to change that exclusion, and it does carry the possibility of making some of the facilities not as available as they have been. I actually, you know, the current plan, which I think is a good plan, involves the treatment component being an outpatient treatment program. It probably would have been good. Maybe that still would be the best plan since he's been in that program for many years now. But at least if our program had been available, it would have been another option, a residential, highly secure, highly accountable, supervised option. But because of the politics associated with it and the inflammatory nature of these cases, we have had to not make our resource available to the Department of Human Services. And, you know, you'd have to ask them, but I have to believe that they would be pleased to at least have another resource available, because they've asked us in the past if we would consider taking people under those circumstances.
Is there anybody else in the testifying or in the room that wishes to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Limerick.
Mr. Chairman, it's been good to have a discussion. I think the public is best served when we discuss issues like this. I remember serving on the Hennepin County Corrections Advisory Board back in the early 1980s with Mr. Kaplan. His hair was a lot darker than it is, and believe me, I had a lot more hair myself. So it's good to cross paths with Mr. Kaplan again, and Mr. Kane, we crossed paths together. I can't remember what year it was anymore, but he ran against me in a re-election bid during my time in the House. And I think it speaks well that we can share the same table on discussing issues like this. what I wanted to do is make sure that I thank the committee for having a discussion regarding this issue. I've been around a long time in the Minnesota legislature, and there never should be an issue that we cannot discuss in a committee. Even if a decision is imminent, there has to be a way that we invite the public to come forward and tell us if we're going down the right path or not, to listen to the facilitators, to try and understand a history of why we're at a point that we are. Unfortunately, we have not had, as a state government, a lot of courage to address the issue of whether or not the Minnesota Sexual Offender Program is working in the best possible way for our people. And now we're facing cost issues, constitutionality questions, and, of course, the issue of that's before us today of whether or not community notification is appropriate or not. I'm going to be asking and recommending that you vote in favor of this bill, despite the history, despite the attention that we have. But more than anything else, I want to thank you for upholding the Senate's role, for deliberation and public discussion on an issue that, unfortunately, was missed by the previous chamber. I stand for a vote, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the bill. I move that Senate File Number 1994, as amended, be recommended to pass and be moved to the floor of the Senate.
To Senator Limmer's bill, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, signify by saying no.
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 The amendment, the bill as amended is adopted. There being no further business before this committee, we stand adjourned.
Hi.